Welcome to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Radio. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, where we focus on the impact of local, state, national, and global issues on the health of the individuals, families, and communities in the Central Catskill region. Health Center in the Catskills is broadcast from the WIOX radio station in Roxbury, New York, which is the ancient and unceded territory of the Esopus clan of the Lenape people, also known as the Munsee, who are the first caretakers living with this land. Today, we live in the influence of what is now called the Lenape Nation of the northeastern woodlands in the United States and Canada. Their territory includes present-day northeastern Delaware, New Jersey, and eastern Pennsylvania along the Delaware River watershed, New York City, western Long Island, and the lower Hudson Valley. Well, we are an aging society and an aging region of New York State. Some of us worry about what will happen when we can no longer take care of ourselves without help. We may not like to think about it, but we should. Long-term care can be challenging to access, difficult to navigate, and expensive. And yet, who among us wants to spend the last months or even years of their lives without options in how we will live those last years and months, and be cared for? Here to talk with us about long-term care are two experts on this topic. First, Liz Siegert is an award-winning health journalist who covers aging topics and is also the topic editor on aging for the Association for Healthcare Journalists and a Health Center correspondent on aging. She recently wrote a column for the Association of Healthcare Journalists that provides basic information on long-term care options. And so I'm delighted, Liz, to have you back on Health Center in the Catskills.
Thanks, Diana. Great to be back.
And I also am pleased to have with us Dr. Melissa Batchelor-Murphy. She is a nurse practitioner, a professor, and director of the Center for Aging, Health, and Humanities at the George Washington University School of Nursing. Melissa and I recently published an op-ed for Stat News on an issue related to staffing in nursing homes that we will talk about today. And Melissa, thank you. I think you're a returning guest as well. Is that right?
I am. That's great to be here.
Great to have you back. And I do want to alert listeners that I'm also going to give an update on what's going on with Mountainside Residential Care Center, our local nursing home. But that will be a little bit later in the program. We're going to devote the whole hour to this discussion because we are an aging county, and it's such an important topic. And when I talk to other people my age, particularly those who may be living alone and not have extended families, it's a real concern. So why don't we start off with what is long-term care and why is this such an important issue for the United States as it is for the Catskill region? And I might point out that Liz Siegert lives in the Hudson Valley just south of us, and so I know it's an important issue there as well. So it is an important issue for an aging population. So let's start with what it is and why it's so important. Melissa, do you want to start that?
Sure. Long-term care itself is a concept that really encompasses any type of care setting that's tailored to the person's needs. So that includes home and community-based services, so like home health or even just having a caregiver that comes into your home that you pay to help, or even family and friends, all the way through to like assisted living. CCRCs is another
form. What is CCRCs?
It's a community-based retirement community. Uh-huh. Continuing care retirement community. So CCRC. Uh-huh. But within that model, you move from independent living to assisted living to skilled care. Okay. To hospice, theoretically. So that's one model of care. But then you can also have independent living facilities, assisted living, and skilled nursing homes, as well as hospice and palliative care. Mm-hmm. So it's really just this trajectory of care services to help meet your needs based on your ability as you age.
And it's also not just for people who are getting older, but it can be also for people with disabilities. Is that correct?
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it depends on, like, how old you are and what your care needs are as to where you end up in this whole trajectory of long-term care.
And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But so why is it so important?
Well, I think it's important because as your care needs change, being aware of the different levels of care that can be provided is important, as well as the financing for each of those different options, because the more you know, the better prepared you are, and you can actually have at least a tentative plan of how you would like things to go, rather than kind of finding yourself on the other side of it where you're just reacting and people are just trying to help you find your way. So it's important to think about it sooner. The sooner the better. So I'm really glad you're talking about it, we're talking about it today.
Now, Liz Siegert, you wrote this piece for the Association of Healthcare Journalists about the various options in long-term care. Melissa just highlighted a few of them. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what each option is and the financing issues specific to each one. We can get into more of a discussion about, you know, ability to pay and who covers things and what they cover. But maybe give us sort of the cliff notes on the various options. And
sure. There, as Melissa mentioned, you know, home care involves usually some type of aid coming into the home and helping with what's called activities of daily living or independent activities of daily living. And that might be cooking, cleaning, shopping, helping somebody take a shower, perhaps doing some other household chores. That's usually paid for by the hour or by the day, and in comparison is probably, and I put this in air quotes, the most affordable of all the options. Mm-hmm. However, if you need somebody 24/7 over the course of the year, that can add up to hundreds of thousands of dollars. The next option up would be continuing care retirement communities, and those can have very steep entry fees, so they're not for everybody. There are some that are more affordable, but again, the more services you need, the more you pay for, and that can cost upwards of $100,000 or more just to be accepted into this community. Plus, you pay rent and additional fees for other services on top of that. Then we have board and care homes, which are smaller versions of nursing homes and assisted living facilities. They may take people who just need a little bit of help, who don't have serious medical conditions. Sometimes there's 3 people or 6 or 10 people in a home. The problem with those is that they're not very well regulated by states, and they're very difficult to find. They often have long waiting lists. One of the newer models is called green homes or greenhouses. It's a new movement that is another alternative to nursing homes. And these are independent, quasi-independent facilities where you have a group setting of perhaps 8 or 10 individuals. They share a common kitchen. They eat meals together, but they each have their own bedrooms. There's usually a care manager on the premises to take care of medical needs, whether it's dispensing medication or just being there to help out. And that's been a very popular model, but again, very difficult to get into with long waiting lists. Assisted living is another option where you can live mostly independently, but again, pay for help as you might need it. For example, getting dressed in the morning. Meals are often in a congregate setting, so there would be a common dining room, although most assisted living facilities also offer perhaps a little kitchenette where you might have a microwave or a toaster oven so you can heat up meals in your room or apartment. And then finally, there's nursing homes. And usually we picture those as these big institutional, very cold type of facilities where you could have literally hundreds of people living in shared rooms commonly. Most of those people are the frailest of the frail. They may have dementia, they may have other chronic health conditions, they may not have any mobility left and need a wheelchair to get around. And these are the places that most of us fear going, and yet many of us still will need that kind of care as we get into the very older ages.
So I want to bring up, and both of you just jump in on your thoughts on this, a couple things. One is we do have a very good local nursing home. I believe the bed capacity is 60. It may be a little higher. And I'll talk more about it a little bit later, but it is it's been a 4- and 5-star CMS nursing home. And, you know, it's a small rural community, so the people who are the caregivers often know the people who are there. For many people, it just really feels like home. It's not the big institutional nursing home that is common to many places. So I want to just clarify that for us in this local community and rural community, there is an option that doesn't quite fit into those categories because it is small, even though it's a nursing home. The other issue is, and Atul Gawande wrote about this, and I'm not remembering the title of the book offhand, On Being Mortal, that's the name of it. He wrote a fabulous book, and it had to do with getting old and dying. And he talked about how assisted living initially was to be, you know, somebody, you know, I live by myself, I need some help, so I'm going to go into this sort of apartment-like place and, you know, just live my life as I want to live it with assistance as I need it. But they have evolved into places where safety is first. So they're going to restrict me from doing certain things because they want to sort of cover their butts on you know, insurance if I fall or what have you. And the freedoms that were initially envisioned in assisted living facilities aren't necessarily there. Melissa, you've been in this, doing this work for a while. What is your take on that?
Well, what we've seen is this evolution of healthcare delivery over the past 30 to 40 years. So basically now our assisted living are like the nursing homes of 30 to 40 years ago. I wanted to clarify that a skilled nursing home, there are short stay and long stay residents in those facilities typically. So you could fall and break a hip and go have a hospital stay, stay there for 3 days, and it triggers your Medicare Part A benefits for rehabilitation. Yeah. And if you cannot do 6 hours of rehabilitation, because we have standalone rehabilitation units, you would be sent to a nursing home, but you would be considered a short stay resident, meaning you should go in there, get your physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, whatever it is you need, and you should be able to transition back home. Compared to the way we have framed, kind of talked about them before, it was more from like the long stay resident perspective.
And it's a really good point because that is a lot of people up here do use the nursing home for short stays for just that purpose.
Right. And so just going to a nursing home shouldn't strike fear into your heart. But I told a lot of people, it's like, you shouldn't stay very long. You know, you're going to get back out of here. And we don't want to keep anyone that doesn't belong there. The point is to help them to get back to a higher level of care, which is more of assisted living. The assisted livings of today are typically more private pay. There's no government financing. And we can talk about the financing with nursing homes later as well. Mm-hmm. But people, the assisted living industries are regulated by the state. So you have varying state regulations. So it's not a federal set of regulations that all the skilled nursing homes have to follow. And because it's private pay and they can continue to charge you more money, but you may go in only needing help with meals and like housekeeping or whatever. You maybe went there for more of a social reason. But then as you decline and become more frail, you know, for only $2,000 more, we can provide that care for you. So it's structured based on your care needs. And because people have this misconception about going to a nursing home, and families have told, you know, their loved ones, we will never put you in a nursing home, they will continue to pay that money until they have depleted it, just to keep the person in assisted living, when that may or may not be the best place for them to get the care that they need. So that's kind of the difference between assisted living and skilled nursing homes.
Really, really good points. Liz, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I just want to back up on to what Melissa's saying. Assisted living, unless you bring in perhaps a home health aide yourself, have very limited staff that can provide what would be considered clinical care. They're just not set up for it. They're set up to be more like a group housing situation or a shared apartment building, depending on your location. So if you need additional care, as Melissa was saying, they may not have the staff on hand that can do rehabilitation for, you know, a knee replacement or work with you on improving your mobility. Whereas in a skilled nursing environment, and she's right, I did leave out that portion of the bigger nursing home, you have much better odds of getting a care plan tailored to your specific health needs.
So let's talk a little bit about, I'm sorry, Melissa, were you jumping in on that?
Well, you may be going where I wanted to go, which is just to talk about the difference in the staffing between assisted living
and skilled. Go ahead.
So Liz is right in the fact that the staff within an assisted living facility, they're not required to have a registered nurse on duty. So you may have a team of like licensed practical nurses, licensed vocational nurses, nursing assistants, med techs, providing the care that you need. And they can provide care up to a certain point, like Liz said, compared to a skilled facility is going to have at least one registered nurse on duty 8 hours a day, but then the bulk of care is also provided by LPNs and nursing assistants. So I think families really don't when we say nursing care, they don't really understand that term can be used because it's licensed nurses and unlicensed nurses, and like a certified nursing assistant, a med tech, combined. Mm-hmm. People think they're going into this facility and they're going to be getting care from a registered nurse, and that's not the case. You'll only find a registered nurse, but it also depends on the facility, because maybe an assisted living facility would hire a registered nurse, particularly if it's a high quality facility. Mm-hmm. So consumers just need to be aware of who's providing the care and what the differences are between a registered nurse, an LPN, a nursing assistant, and a med tech.
So I'm going to come back to that because I want to talk about the new rule that we wrote about and delve more deeply into the staffing issue because it's such an important topic. Before we do that, though, I want to talk about how this stuff is paid for. Now, you've mentioned that assisted living is private pay. Many people think that they'll be able to go to a nursing home when they need it and Medicare will pay for it. So who wants to tackle how this care is financed?
Well, I'll jump in.
Okay.
First of all, that's a misnomer. Medicare will pay for care in the skilled nursing part of this facility up to a period of time. And that only involves the housing, the meals that you're provided while you're there, and any clinical care you need. But when you need long-term care, when you must stay there as your housing option indefinitely, and you switch over to the long-term care side, the primary payer is Medicaid. They pay for 60% of all nursing home residents. And that's because nursing homes are incredibly expensive. The average one-year cost of a long-term care stay in a facility like that is around $110,000.
Just mind-boggling.
You can. They will happily accept private pay residents, But most people do not have that kind of money, and certainly for not an extended period of time. So many are forced to go on to Medicaid by spending down whatever assets they have. And depending on where you live, in New York State, I believe you're allowed $2,000 in the bank account. And there are some protections for spouses. But generally, you are nearly bankrupting yourself, so you can qualify for Medicaid and get them to pay for the long-term care.
So the other issue is there is all this discussion around we need to take long-term care to people's homes. And there used to be in the United States, or in New York State, what was called the Lombardi program, where indeed you had visiting nurses who would come in and home health aides as you needed, because it was cheaper than having you go to a nursing facility. Instead of $110,000 a year, it might have been $90,000 a year. I'm pulling those numbers out of the air, but it was less expensive. I'm not quite sure what happened to that, but there is this movement to try to get back to more home-based long-term care, because really, who does want to leave their home? People don't. Obviously, staffing is an issue, but I'd like you all both to talk about what's going on with long-term care in the home, and do you think there is a future for that? Liz? Go ahead, Liz.
There's certainly a future for it. AARP surveys consistently find that upwards of 90% of people want to stay at home or in their community as they age. But in order to do that, they may need to modify their home. They may need to put in a wheelchair ramp or something simple like grab bars in the bathroom. They may need to tap into what's called home and community-based services, which might be something like Meals on Wheels, or it might be a friendly visitor program, or it might be an adult day center or a senior center. If you live in a more rural area, you then need transportation to those places. Many older people have stopped driving, or certainly won't drive after dark. So there are a whole host of issues, without even getting into the staffing challenges, that have to be addressed.
And Melissa, do you have a take on that?
Well, I think that we're going to have to continue to build up our home and community-based services, because we just don't have the beds to institutionalize people, and people don't want to be institutionalized. I mean, if you're put into a skilled facility for a long-term period of time, it's because you are the sickest and the frailest. And I do want to clarify that only about 5% of the population over the age of 65 ever end up spending some time living in a skilled facility. So I want that to be very clear. We're talking about a very small percentage of our population, but Liz is right. In most states, they account for about 60% of the Medicaid budget. Wow. So it's one of those situations that it's not good. If we have more people than what we currently have, it's going to bankrupt the states. And so we are having to be more innovative and more proactive in developing these home and community-based services. One program is called Capable. Yes. Sarah Zanton from Hopkins developed that, where they send in a handyman, a social worker, and a nurse to try to do the home-based care planning that needs to be happening, whether it's having somebody fix up the home, modify the home in some way, connect them to community resources, as well as looking at health care. That's been a very innovative program that a lot of states are implementing. But I also think it's going to take grassroots and private industry. One of the grassroots models is called the Villages, and it's neighbors helping neighbors. You kind of join this volunteer group when you're maybe a little younger to help out people in your neighborhood, go to doctor's offices, go to the grocery store, do some of those home repairs. So that's another model of care that's emerged, or model of, I guess it is care. Yeah. And then with private industry, I live in Wilmington, North Carolina, and when I moved here, one of the companies that's new, it's called Care Yaya, where they are hiring UNC students from UNC Wilmington to work with older adults in this community, and it's almost like a Rover app. You decide what services you need, and you can hire a student who has had a criminal background check that can come into your home and do just basic things if you don't have friends and neighbors that can help you. So I think it's going to take a combination of the government, private industry, and neighbors helping neighbors as the demographic shift. And we have about 25 years to get this figured out, because most people think when we're talking about long-term care, we really should be focused on the boomers. Well, that's true, because they are today's older adults. But the millennials took over as the largest generation 3 years ago, and 2 years ago they started turning 40, which makes them old enough to sue for age discrimination in the workplace. We have about 25 years until the millennials start turning 65, and so it needs to be something that everyone is talking about and thinking about and coming up with solutions.
I want to share a personal approach that I've been doing. So during COVID, I had a pod. There were sometimes four of us in the pod, sometimes five. And we're all older women, excuse me, and we're friends. And excuse me, one of my friends recently had to be hospitalized, and I was like, well, I was there to help her and took her to the emergency room. And I thought, I don't even know who to call. I don't know who in her family to call. I don't know what insurance she has. There was a whole lot I didn't know. And then when she was being discharged, it was like, how do we support her? Because there's no home care up here hardly at all right now because of staffing shortages. So we got together. I created this form where we put down information related to who our primary care provider was, what our physical address was, our mailing address, what our insurance is, and who our healthcare proxy is, and the person's phone number and email address. We then identified if something happens, and I'm going to say for me, if something happens to me, then who are the first people that my friends should contact? And that would include my healthcare proxy. It would include the rest of them because they're my good friends and buddies up here. One family member in my extended family who can alert the rest of the family if need be. And then a list of who are people that they could call to say, Diana's coming home. We need to get meals to her. We need to have somebody check in on her. Would you take Tuesday? Would you take Wednesday? Would you go shopping for her? Would you come in and clean for her? And so how to create your own network that of volunteers, essentially, until we can organize the kind of volunteer effort that I think you're talking about, Melissa. I feel like it could be a real asset to people in communities that have a shortage of staff and don't have a lot of services.
Yeah, basically you took your friends through a care team building exercise. Ah. So kudos to you.
Say more about
that. It's thinking through who is your network. And I love the fact that you actually had your friends, you know, we all need to write this down. Yeah. The other thing to think about as you age is, you know, kind of having a little emergency book, like if you were to pass away, like what are all the different accounts you have? What are the passwords? Good. I mean, doing good. That level of work for your healthcare proxy
good.
Is also critically important.
Oh, that's really good. Okay. That's my next step then.
Yeah, so there are a number of apps that you can download for your phone or onto your computer that will coordinate, kind of like, or you could set up a simple Google calendar that has shared access so that if somebody, for example, you know, can take you to a doctor's appointment, they can put that right in the calendar.
That's a great idea. So let me just pause and say that for listeners, you're listening to HealthCetera in the Catskills. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, and we're on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20. And if you're on the campus of SUNY Delhi, tune in to 107.5 FM. And, of course, you can listen anywhere, at WIOXradio.org. That's WIOXradio.org. I'm not going to talk about the weather on the break except to say it's going to keep raining. Look forward to Sunday. It's supposed to be a sunny day on Sunday. So there's my weather report. And the time is 2:31. And we're talking today about long-term care. And with me is Dr. Melissa Batchelor-Murphy, a professor and director of the Center for Aging at the George Washington University School of Nursing, and Liz Siegert, who's an award-winning journalist who covers aging issues. She lives in the Hudson Valley, and she is also has been a HealthCetera correspondent on aging for us and writes for the Association for Healthcare Journalists on Aging. So I want to switch now to the issue of quality of particularly nursing homes. And you know, as I said, Mountainside Residential Care Center is the nursing home in our community that's been a 4- and 5-star CMS nursing home. They, during COVID, nobody got COVID for the first three years. I think somebody came down with COVID once everybody got lax again. But they really did a good job, although you could say, well, but then did people really die of isolation? So there is that other level of complexity to it. But it's a good nursing home. Now, New York State, there is a link. The research has shown that all the deaths that occurred, there were so many deaths that occurred in nursing homes during COVID, and there was have been some analyses of what were the factors that contributed to those deaths. Why did Mountainside have none, and why did some other nursing homes have really horrible numbers? And one of the key factors was staffing. And so New York State has passed a law saying that you have to have, or maybe it's a regulation, there is a minimum nurse staffing that you have to have in nursing homes of certified nursing assistants and RNs. And because of that, Mountainside had to close beds. They didn't have enough CNAs in this time when everybody's struggling to get healthcare workers. They didn't have enough CNAs or RNs. And what it did really, I think, was to force the nursing home to look at, well, how are we going to address this? We've got to reopen beds, but we've got to get staff, so what are we going to do? They now have a certified nursing assistant course, and when you come out of that course, you get, if you're hired, you have a job that's paying $25 an hour, and that's about $50,000 a year plus benefits. They have staffed enough RNs now, and so it is possible, and they're opening beds. So it's an example of how, while people may think, oh, this is horrible to have this minimum, to have shut down beds if you don't have enough staff. Melissa, I want you to speak to why does it matter whether you have enough staff? What do we know from the research about staffing in nursing homes?
Well, what we know is that the higher your staffing levels are and the more training that staff has, the less negative outcomes we see, all the way from someone falling and breaking a hip and ending up being rehospitalized to a person, you know, bladder infection turning into sepsis. So having a registered nurse on duty 24 hours, 7 days a week matters, and that is based on, you know, many different studies. And the issue, I think, when you're talking about whether it was a law or regulation, the federal government sets the regulations for the state, but the states can amp that up if they choose to. They just can't do anything less than what the federal government requires. But if you have 30 residents to care for, and again, these are the sickest, frailest people, and you're the only nursing assistant there, I mean, people are going to get hurt and things are going to get missed.
And in fact, I want to say it was about 9 to 12 months ago, there was a couple cases in New York where patients, I think, to the north of us, residents of a nursing home north to us, were actually taken to the emergency room for dehydration. They couldn't get water. They didn't have enough staff to refill the water bottles. And that's, to me, just criminal. It speaks to why if you can't do this basic kind of care, then you should close beds.
Exactly.
So talk about this CMS rule that we wrote about, and yeah, and some of the pushback. Let's tell that story.
Okay. So right prior to this new rule being passed by CMS, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, nursing homes were only required to have one registered nurse on duty for 8 hours a day. And the new final rule that was passed, in, which is a rule set by CMS, says that there should be an RN on duty for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And there's been a lot of pushback. This is an evidence-based rule that CMS has been working on. There were over 60,000 public comments on it. But this is an evidence-based rule that they have put into place with some stipulations for more rural. They've given a grace period for the nursing homes that aren't already meeting this requirement. Many are in this country. But the pushback is really coming now from our for-profit and our not-for-profit nursing homes, because that's another difference between the two. You have for-profit and not-for-profit. So the industry is saying that they can't afford to improve staffing, which we can. And the second issue they have is that there's no one to hire, and the third one is that they think this is government overreach. But nursing homes have been regulated in this country for the past 40 years. That was a law passed by Congress, and then to execute that, it was given to the CMS as the executive branch to set these quality and safety oversight standards for the nursing home industry. They've been doing that for 40 years. So for them to implement an evidence-based rule and the industry to say that's government overreach is a little silly.
Particularly government pays for most of the care.
Right. This is taxpayer dollars that we're talking about. Yeah. The nursing home industry, many of the corporations are actually private equity firms that own these individual facilities, and their average profit margin is nearly 9%. Yeah. So they are seeing, and the way they're, the other part of this rule is the transparency, the financial transparency that the government is asking for, because right now nursing homes spend 39% of their revenue on direct care, 34% is on administration, but only 27% of their budget is actually spent on nursing care, and that's the skilled nursing, the staffing piece of it.
And they've set a minimum number of nursing hours per patient per day, which it's I want to point out that even though we're saying it's evidence based, if they really followed the evidence, the requirement would be higher, the minimum level would be higher. So this is not as high as I think and probably you think they should go, but it's making progress on staffing in nursing homes. Would you agree with that?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Liz, do you have any take on this issue?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, the staffing requirement to have an RN is not, the RN now must be on premises. A lot of time, including weekends, a lot of time they would have an RN on call. Uh-huh. Especially on a Saturday or a Sunday, but they weren't required to be actually on site. And that makes a whole lot of difference in supervision and in delivering the kind of quality care people need. There's been a lot of pushback, as you mentioned, from private equity, from various nursing home associations, who are claiming they can't find the staff, that they'll have to close beds because they'll be forced to hire people at increased wages, but it's tenuous. There's a very tenuous link. One of the tricks that a lot of private equity firms use, and also real estate investment trusts are involved in this, is that they create secondary shell companies. So, for example, they might also own the company that supplies the bed linens, or they might own the company that delivers the food supplies. So they're basically paying themselves twice out of this money. Mm. So when they say that they don't have the funds to hire more staff or to increase wages to retain the staff that they have, I think people, and again, not every nursing home does this, but there have been a number of investigative reports, especially by the New York Times and KFF Health News, that have really pointed to real problems in how the lack of transparency among nursing home owners is hurting residents.
Yeah, that's really good points. Now, I do want to talk a minute about a letter that Melissa and I got from our piece in Stat News on this topic from a nursing home director, I think based in Staten Island, who I looked up the nursing home, and it looked absolutely fabulous. And from what I could see, it was a high quality nursing home. And he said, we're hardly breaking even now. And so I don't know how I'm going to pay for this. So one of the other issues, and he was quite genuine. I mean, I was quite moved by his letter. But there are a couple things that I think are relevant here, and Melissa, maybe you can speak to this. One is that CMS is recognizing that recruiting is an issue and has made some funds available. But I think the other issue, and both of you tackled this one, is that we don't pay enough for this, right? I mean, nursing homes, it's a struggle. I mean, the nurses, the CNAs, and even the nurses, routinely the wages was so far below anything else in healthcare that they did have problems recruiting and retaining. And I think this New York regulation is forcing nursing homes to be a little bit more competitive, but nursing homes are closing right and left. What are your thoughts on that, Melissa?
Yeah, I mean, I can remember being a director of nursing trying to hire, you know, an RN, and, you know, she's like, well, what's the pay? And I was like, it's $14 an hour. And this was in 1996. And she, you know, just like belly laughed at me. And I'm like, well, that's what it is. When the hospital down the street, you know, is paying $19 to $20 an hour. Yeah. And it's like, you're not going to be a competitive workplace. And I've always said the people that work in nursing homes, the majority of them are not there for the money.
Yeah.
You know, so it's been an interesting dynamic. But, you know, when you think about how these nursing homes are, how they are spending their money, and how much profit they are making, I just feel like they can bring these wages up. And if they look at kind of workforce retention, you know, how do you invest in better pay, better benefits, better working conditions? You know, you can't attract and retain quality staff. I mean, but what we have is a couple of bad apples in this bunch that shine, you know, a negative light on the entire industry. It's kind of a catch 22.
And we should point out that turnover of staff is quite costly. It costs to recruit staff. So that's an additional expense if you can't retain your staff that you could be putting into creating a wage and benefit package that might be more attractive. Liz, what about how we pay for care?
Well, again, you know, nursing homes do rely a lot on government reimbursement, and Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement has not been traditionally very high. And that's something that I think policymakers, both at the state level and the federal level, do need to look at, because if the demographics are what they are, there's going to be more people aging, there's going to be more people living longer with serious chronic illness, and there will always be a group of people where placement in a nursing home is the right move for them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have the staff to take care of them, and they're forced to be put on a waiting list, or they have to move 100 miles away from family and friends, that's a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that's going to get better overnight. Some nursing homes are trying to attract more private pay patients by making themselves more like an assisted living facility, or, you know, putting in more, you know, additional services like happy hour. But for the most part, you know, it does come down to wages and benefits. The other thing with nursing homes, again, this is not to paint all of them with a broad brush, but many do not have a career path for their workers. So if you join as a nursing assistant, there isn't a real option for you to move out of that role and demand higher wages and gain a, you know, additional licensure unless you do it on your own dime. If you're being paid $14 or $15 an hour, it's very hard to do that. Many of the staff work two jobs just to make ends meet, and many of them are on Medicaid themselves.
And I think you're speaking to where I think we have to be much more creative with developing pipelines and career paths. So why can't you take that certified nursing assistant, give them some credit, have them go become an LPN, then move on to RN. We've got already an LPN to RN pathway. We have an RN to BSN, or you can go directly to the BS baccalaureate degree. We also have an entry into a doctorate of nursing practice. So nursing's been very creative about these educational pathways, but I think what's missing is one that's really focused on care of older adults and from a long-term care perspective, that CNA, how we work those certified nursing assistants in and give them opportunities for growth. I just came last week from a meeting where we were talking about workforce in primary care, and it became very clear that we can't just talk primary care. And so we talked about, and we had the two superintendents of the local schools there who said, you know, we have students who aren't going to go to college, and it would be great to have them have this career path to become certified nursing assistants. And we've got room in our curriculum to provide them time to do that. So we're hoping that there will be a partnership between the nursing home and the schools to provide over the last 4 to 6 months a CNA training for these students. And when they come out, they can apply then for these jobs. And like I said, they're paying over $50,000 a year with benefits. So that's, I feel like that's at least a good start of looking at how to develop a pipeline that can really serve long-term care needs, as well as they could be working in the hospitals in the area and probably even get a job in terms of some of that nursing, some of that home care piece. So these are really important issues. Anything that you want to add to that, Melissa or Liz?
I think that's an awesome approach, and I think more community colleges in particular should be partnering with the local high schools. I see it here as well. I live in Dutchess County, and our community colleges here do outreach to the high schools for students that are not on necessarily a college track. But part of the problem I hear is that, well, who wants to go work in a nursing home when I could be making almost the same kind of money at Target?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They're paying $25 an hour?
They're paying $20.
Wow. Jeez. Yeah, and that's working, at Target, and a CNA has responsibility for caring for humans. It's sort of dumbfounding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, but I also think there's a lot of ageism, which has kind of been the underlying theme with a lot of this discussion today. Is, you know, when I was in nursing school, I was like, I'm never going to work with older adults. I'm never going to work in a nursing home. Like, I've never actually had a student come into the school, but very few have come into the school of nursing and said, I can't wait to work in a nursing home, and I want to work with older adults. And it's like, well, by default, we're all going to work with older adults. I got my first job in a nursing home. I've actually never worked in a hospital. But once I got there, I was like, I love this. I love their stories. I love the people. I like working with their families. I feel like I'm making a difference. You know, so instead of, we need to change this narrative of, well, why would I work at a nursing home? To the answer to that should be, well, let me tell you why. I have met people who were born in 1898 who lived long enough to see, you know, electricity and running water and trains for the first time. And, you know, all the things that have happened, you know, with women in society. you know, these people live through that, you know, and the history and the things that you learn are incredible. And that's why you should work in a nursing home.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. And we only have about 4 minutes left, and I want to get in two things. I want to get in from each of you. What are three tips that you would have for people for when they're looking at long-term care options or selecting a nursing home, what they ought to look for? And what is one resource that you would send people to? Liz, do you want to start that?
Sure. First of all, I think it's important that you plan ahead. Don't wait until you or your loved one is in a crisis situation, because then you often don't have as many options. Second, you have to come up with a realistic plan based on financial considerations, based on where you live, based on availability of family and friends. So that's an important situation. And while people may want to stay at home, in some cases it just may not be the best option for them because of lack of resources. Third, I think you need to have really honest discussions about what matters and what matters most to you.
Yeah.
Is it the longevity? Is it the independence? Is it remaining in your community with your friends? Mm-hmm. Those tend to spur different discussions with different options.
Yeah.
And as far as a resource, I would absolutely call your county area agency on aging. Mm-hmm. Which can point you to the local resources that are available within your zip code. Good. And that might include rides to a doctor's appointment or adult daycare centers or something which we all know of. It's called the PACE program, Program for All-Inclusive Care of the Elderly, which is another home-based option to get nursing care at home rather than having to travel to doctor's offices and so on.
Yeah.
But there's often a waiting list, so it might be a good time to think about it before you need it.
Thank you. Those are good tips. And Melissa?
Well, I'll start with my resource. I host a weekly podcast called This Is Getting Old, Moving Towards an Age-Friendly World. And I talk about this topic quite often. I have several on the different levels of care. So it's melissabphd.com. I agree with Liz about contacting your area agency on aging. If you are needing to find a nursing home now, I have a podcast episode about how to find a nursing home, but you can also go to CMS, just Google CMS guide for choosing a nursing home. They have a checklist that you can download and print out and take print one for each facility you're going to visit, and that will help you make your decision. And my last piece of advice is that while you think you're saving for retirement, you are actually saving for long-term care. Mm. So, again, save your money, educate yourself, and most importantly is take care of yourself so that you age well and can live a long, healthy, productive life.
And that was Dr. Melissa Batchelor-Murphy, who is a professor, a nurse practitioner and professor and director of the Center for Aging, Health and Humanities at the George Washington University School of Nursing. And she does a fabulous job of this podcast. This is Getting Old. Google it. It's excellent. And she's got great resources there for all kinds of aging issues. So, Melissa, thank you for coming back on to Health Center in the Catskills today.
Thank you.
And before her was Liz Siegert, an award-winning journalist who covers aging issues, lives in the Hudson Valley, and recently wrote about long-term care options for the Association for Healthcare Journalists. Liz is a fabulous journalist. Look up her writing. Siegert is S-E-E-G-E-R-T. And thank you, Liz, for coming back on to Health Center. This has been a great discussion.
Anytime, Diana.
Thank you both. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, you too.
So, yeah, really good stuff there. Terrific. And those are great resources. I really hope you'll look for those resources. You've been listening to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains. And I'm Diana Mason. Yes, Health Center in the Catskills. And you can listen to prior Health Center in the Catskills segments at healthmediapolicy.com. That's healthmediapolicy.com. Have a great day.